Such an ideal went far beyond the legal profession or the ministry and its influence. Even in the everyday world of commerce, the resonances of rational typographic discourse were to be found. If we may take advertising to be the voice of commerce, then its history tells very clearly that in the 18th and 19th centuries, those with products to sell took their customers to be not unlike Daniel Webster. They assumed that potential buyers were literate, rational, analytical. Indeed, the history of newspaper advertising in America may be considered all by itself as a metaphor of the descent of the typographic mind, beginning as it does with reason and ending as it does with entertainment. In Frank Presbrey's classic study, The History and Development of Advertising, he discusses the decline of typography, dating its demise in the late 1860s and early 1870s. He refers to the period before then as the Dark Ages of typographical display. The Dark Ages to which he refers began in 1704, when the first paid advertisements appeared in an American newspaper, the Boston Newsletter. These were three in number, occupying altogether 4 inches of single-column space. One of them offered a reward for the capture of a thief, another offered a reward for the return of an anvil that was taken up by some unknown party. The third actually offered something for sale, and in fact is not unlike real estate advertisements one might see in today's New York Times. At Oyster Bay on Long Island in the province of New York, there is a very good fulling mill to be let or sold, as also a plantation, having on it a large new brick house and another good house by it for a kitchen and workhouse with a barn, stable, and so forth, a young orchard, and 20 acres clear land. The mill is to be let with or without the plantation. Inquire of Mr. William Bradford, printer in New York, and no further. For more than a century and a half afterward, advertisements took this form with minor alterations. For example, 64 years after Mr. Bradford advertised an estate in Oyster Bay, the legendary Paul Revere placed the following advertisement in the Boston Gazette. Whereas many persons are so unfortunate as to lose their foreteeth by accident and other ways to their great detriment, not only in looks, but speaking both in public and private, this is to inform all such that they may have them replaced with false ones that look as well as the natural and answers the end of speaking to all intents, by Paul Revere, goldsmith, near the head of Dr. Clark's Wharf, Boston. Revere went on to explain in another paragraph that those whose false teeth had been fitted by John Baker, and who had suffered the indignity of having them loosen, might come to Revere to have them tightened. He indicated that he had learned how to do this from John Baker himself. Not until almost 100 years after Revere's announcement were there any serious attempts by advertisers to overcome the lineal typographic form demanded by publishers. And not until the end of the 19th century did advertising move fully into its modern mode of discourse. As late as 1890, advertising, still understood to consist of words, was regarded as an essentially serious and rational enterprise, whose purpose was to convey information and make claims in propositional form. Advertising was, as Stephen Douglas said in another context, intended to appeal to understanding, not to passions. This is not to say that during the period of typographic display the claims that were put forward were true. Words cannot guarantee their truth content. Rather, they assemble a context in which the question, is this true or false, is relevant. In the 1890s, that context was shattered, first by the massive intrusion of illustrations and photographs, then by the non-propositional use of language. For example, in the 1890s, advertisers adopted the technique of using slogans. Presbrey contends that modern advertising can be said to begin with the use of two such slogans, "You press the button, we do the rest," and "See that hump?" At about the same time, jingles started to be used, and in 1892, Procter & Gamble invited the public to submit rhymes to advertise Ivory soap. In 1896, H.O. employed, for the first time, a picture of a baby in a high chair, the bowl of cereal before him, his spoon in hand, his face ecstatic. By the turn of the century, advertisers no longer assumed rationality on the part of their potential customers. Advertising became one part depth psychology, one part aesthetic theory. Reason had to move itself to other arenas. To understand the role that the printed word played in providing an earlier America with its assumptions about intelligence, truth, and the nature of discourse, one must keep in view that the act of reading in the 18th and 19th centuries had an entirely different quality to it than the act of reading does today. For one thing, as I have said, the printed word had a monopoly on both attention and intellect, there being no other means, besides the oral tradition, to have access to public knowledge. Public figures were known largely by their written words, for example, not by their looks or even their oratory. It is quite likely that most of the first 15 presidents of the United States would not have been recognized had they passed the average citizen in the street. This would have been the case as well of the great lawyers, ministers, and scientists of that era. To think about those men was to think about what they had written, to judge them by their public positions, their arguments, their knowledge as codified in the printed word. You may get some sense of how we are separated from this kind of consciousness by thinking about any of our recent presidents or even preachers, lawyers, and scientists who are or who have recently been public figures. Think of Richard Nixon or Jimmy Carter or Billy Graham or even Albert Einstein, and what will come to your mind is an image, a picture of a face, most likely a face on a television screen, in Einstein's case, a photograph of a face. Of words, almost nothing will come to mind. This is the difference between thinking in a word-centered culture and thinking in an image-centered culture. It is also the difference between living in a culture that provides little opportunity for leisure and one that provides much. The farm boy following the plow with book in hand, the mother reading aloud to her family on a Sunday afternoon, the merchant reading announcements of the latest clipper arrivals, these were different kinds of readers from those of today. There would have been little casual reading, for there was not a great deal of time for that. Reading would have had a sacred element in it, or if not that, would have at least occurred as a daily or weekly ritual invested with special meaning. For we must also remember that this was a culture without electricity. It would not have been easy to read by either candlelight or, later, gaslight. Doubtless much reading was done between dawn and the start of the day's business. What reading would have been done was done seriously, intensely, and with steadfast purpose. The modern idea of testing a reader's comprehension as distinct from something else a reader may be doing would have seemed an absurdity in 1790 or 1830 or 1860. What else was reading but comprehending? As far as we know, there did not exist such a thing as a reading problem, except, of course, for those who could not attend school. To attend school meant to learn to read, for without that capacity one could not participate in the culture's conversations. But most people could read and did participate. To these people, reading was both their connection to and their model of the world. The printed page revealed the world, line by line, page by page, to be a serious, coherent place, capable of management by reason and of improvement by logical and relevant criticism. Almost anywhere one looks in the 18th and 19th centuries, then, one finds the resonances of the printed word, and in particular its inextricable relationship to all forms of public expression. It may be true, as Charles Beard wrote, that the primary motivation of the writers of the United States Constitution was the protection of their economic interests, but it is also true that they assumed that participation in public life required the capacity to negotiate the printed word. To them, mature citizenship was not conceivable without sophisticated literacy, which is why the voting age in most states was set at 21, and why Jefferson saw in universal education America's best hope. And that is also why, as Allen Nevins and Henry Steele Commager have pointed out, the voting restrictions against those who owned no property were frequently overlooked, but not one's inability to read. It may be true, as Frederick Jackson Turner wrote, that the spirit that fired the American mind was the fact of an ever-expanding frontier, but it is also true, as Paul Anderson has written, that it is no mere figure of speech to say that farm boys followed the plow with book in hand, be it Shakespeare, Emerson, or Thoreau. For it was not only a frontier mentality that led Kansas to be the first state to permit women to vote in school elections, or Wyoming the first state to grant complete equality in the franchise. Women were probably more adept readers than men, and even in the frontier states, the principal means of public discourse issued from the printed word. Those who could read had, inevitably, to become part of the conversation. It may also be true, as Perry Miller has suggested, that the religious fervor of Americans provided much of their energy, or, as earlier historians told it, that America was created by an idea whose time had come. I quarrel with none of these explanations. I merely observe that the America they try to explain was dominated by a public discourse which took its form from the products of the printing press. For two centuries, America declared its intentions, expressed its ideology, designed its laws, sold its products, created its literature, and addressed its deities with black squiggles on white paper. It did its talking in typography, and with that as the main feature of its symbolic environment, rose to prominence in world civilization. The name I give to that period of time during which the American mind submitted itself to the sovereignty of the printing press is the Age of Exposition. Exposition is a mode of thought, a method of learning, and a means of expression. Almost all of the characteristics we associate with mature discourse were amplified by typography, which has the strongest possible bias toward exposition, a sophisticated ability to think conceptually, deductively, and sequentially, a high valuation of reason and order, an abhorrence of contradiction, a large capacity for detachment and objectivity, and a tolerance for delayed response. Toward the end of the 19th century, for reasons I am most anxious to explain, the Age of Exposition began to pass, and the early signs of its replacement could be discerned. Its replacement was to be the Age of Show Business.